Understanding power requires more than headlines. I'm Peter Hamby, host of The Powers That Be, a podcast from PUC examining politics, economics, and media to provide context, analysis, and clarity without sensationalism. We ask how power operates, who benefits, and what's at stake. If you want to move beyond breaking news to deeper understanding, join us on The Powers That Be. New episodes every weekday. Follow The Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. In the rising world of AI, more jobs are going unfilled. What's behind this trend? Here's WCCO.
Is it a skill issue or a headcount issue? But only 9% businesses that responded to a recent survey say that they have enough people to meet what they intend to do. That only 9% feel that they're fully resourced to do their jobs. That's pretty alarming. Let's get to the bottom of that. Robert Half Companies did the survey, and from Robert Half, joining us right now is Ryan Evers. That's pretty alarming. 9%. Is that a skill, not enough skill or not enough people?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Thanks for having me. I would say in our market, for the last couple of years, it's really been kind of a, do more with less, or yep, at least the same, has really been kind of the motto. And I think as companies are finally getting into a point where, tariffs seem to have settled and, they're a little bit more confident in kind of what the 2026 business outlook brings, not just for the Minneapolis market, but for kind of the national market, they are getting more confident in hiring, both in the permanent and the contract space.
Well, that would be good news, because we've seen, some massive layoffs by some huge companies so far already this year. What about local companies? So they feel confident enough that they plan on doing some hiring this year?
Yeah, I think for the last couple of years, we've seen a lot of companies have been kind of putting projects on hold. There's natural technology investment, right? Whether it be with AI or new implementations kind of coming on board. We've seen those continue to be pushed from quarter to quarter, and kind of coming into 2026, small, medium, and large sized businesses are starting to kind of get to a point where they're ready to kind of invest in head, whether that's consulting or permanent. So we've seen kind of the trend start to increase in both sides.
When we talk about a skill gap, meaning companies that can't find the people with the skills they need, are there specific industries where we see that more than others?
I would say every industry, I think, is seeing it right now. Healthcare is a tough one. We look at our business by kind of the specific functions, whether it be finance and accounting, healthcare, legal, HR, technology is definitely a difficult one. I think a lot of companies are still kind of grappling with the impact of AI and trying to figure out, how do we best use AI in our business? What is safe? There's a lot of questions around there. Because it's new, there's also not a lot of people that are kind of super well-versed in that and how to kind of take an organization to the next level. So, I would say certainly healthcare is one of them. Finance and accounting continues to be a segment of the business that it's challenging to find kind of the right skill sets for the jobs that are open.
Talking to Ryan Evers from Robert Half Companies, going through the numbers of this latest survey. We talked to a professor at University of St. Thomas once a month, and he always talks about AI and the role it's having. And he was just in here last week talking about how these entry-level jobs at white-collar companies are just diminishing. Have you seen that too, that it's tougher for students who are just coming out of college to find those, entry-level white-collar jobs that used to be there?
In some respects, I mean, there's still opportunity out there. I think organizations are trying to bring entry-level candidates in and maybe trying to upskill them a little bit faster. I mean, certainly you come out of college with, a lot of kind of transferable skills, but you've got to figure out how to apply them immediately in, whatever industry you land in. So I think organizations are working really hard to bring their new people in and kind of have maybe even higher expectations today of what they'll contribute than they used to in the past.
The survey said, 70% of Minneapolis businesses, a manager said that hiring has become harder due to the rise in AI-generated applications. Can you explain that a little more about what is problematic about those applications and why might that make things more difficult for people who are hiring?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's a couple things that make it problematic. There are a lot more resumes that just aren't real. We've seen it in our business as well, where we will see three or four identical resumes with the exception of the candidate's name and
really?
The company names. Oh, yeah, all the time. Sometimes they change the dates, but for the most part, the bullet points underneath are very, very similar. And you can just look at them and, you know, I think with trained eye, you can see that it's AI generated. The other thing is just the sheer volume of resumes coming through. There's a lot of, you know, bots that are applying and doing auto applies. When we see a client that has a posted job order, we often reach out to them. And a lot of times the first response we get from a client is, oh, we're sitting really well. We've got 300 applicants. We're in good shape. We call them a week or 2 weeks later, and then, you know, you find out after you kind of, you know, cut through all the details of who's overqualified and who's significantly underqualified, you've got typically a pretty small pool. The other thing is a lot of people are able to polish their resume up to a level that is perfection and speaks exactly to the job description, and they may not actually have the skills that are on the resume. So I think, you know, interviewing and asking very specific pointed questions becomes even more important in a market like this.
Certainly, we know what the pitfalls for people who are hiring these companies when they hire folks like that. But for people listening right now, Ryan, who maybe have a student or are a student who might be finishing up and looking for a job, what kind of advice would you give them to make sure that their resume is one that people who are hiring can feel confident about?
For sure. I would say any types of specific kind of projects in college or, you know, kind of successes that you've had where there's a quantifiable kind of return on investment or ROI statement, you know, use those kind of things. Companies are looking for people that have a demonstrated background in, you know, making a process better or, you know, improving X, Y, or Z. I think those are helpful. Communication skills in general are just, you know, very, very important. The other thing, you know, obviously partnering with a search firm, partnering whether it be a contingent search firm or one that does direct hire permanent placement, getting an opportunity to meet with a recruiter, we will be honest. And if there are things in an interview or, you know, the way you answer a question or kind of the way you show up, we'll give you the feedback because our goal is to help you. Our goal is to, you know, place you in the right opportunity that really speaks to what you went to school for and what you're ultimately looking for. And so I think having that level of partnership for somebody that's going to give you honest feedback, but then being open to the honest feedback and being willing to kind of make the corrections to kind of get yourself kind of that next great opportunity.
Lastly, for you, because I want to make sure that this isn't all, you know, doom and gloom. I'm encouraged that, as your survey pointed out, 55% of businesses in Minneapolis plan to add permanent staff, 52% expand to increase contract hiring, and 73% overall of hiring managers say they're confident in their business outlook for this year. How important is that, and how encouraging are those numbers to you?
It's very encouraging. I've been with Robert Half for over 20 years, and I think the last couple of years have certainly been a challenge. I think companies, as they put positions on hold or if they've lost somebody and chose not to maybe refill that position, they've started to feel the squeeze and the difficulty in continuing to operate at the level that they need to. And so I'm very, very encouraged. I think it's a really great market, Minneapolis specifically in the Twin Cities, kind of the surrounding area. We've always been a strong market. You know, I think there's a lot of great opportunities out there for great people. Really good people know their value in the market, and, you know, people are still kind of moving to different opportunities, which ultimately frees up opportunity for other people to kind of come behind. So I'm very, very encouraged. I think it's a great market, and hopefully that will continue to kind of show itself for the remainder of the year.
So that's the effect of AI on the job market. But what about AI and your health? Here's KCBS.
Hey everyone, I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air, and we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did, and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.
Artificial intelligence is now helping doctors diagnose patients, file documents, and even perform surgery. As these tools spread across hospitals and clinics, Patients are wondering how care will change as doctors worry about what their future roles might be. For more on this, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Dr. Bob Wachter, professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at UCSF. He recently wrote a book on this called A Giant Leap, How AI is Transforming Healthcare and What That Means for Our Future. Now, I guess we should make one thing clear at the beginning, that AI is not the future of medicine. It is the present of medicine, isn't it?
When I attend and see patients on the wards at UCSF now, I'm using AI to help create my note. I'm using AI to summarize maybe your past record, which in many cases is longer than 500 pages, using AI to help me think of all the diagnoses that might be going on. I'm still the final decision maker, but it definitely is not the future. It is today.
I'll bet it must save a lot of time and, you know, fatigue. Filling out charts, I think, has to be one of the most laborious things that a physician does.
Well, if you think about seeing your doctor in the last 10 or 15 years, since we finally got computers about 15 years ago, you may have noticed that the doctor wasn't looking you in the eye, but was spending all of his or her time down at the keyboard pecking away. And what some of the newer AI tools are doing is I put a phone on the desk between me and you as a patient. I'll ask your permission, and then I can look you in the eye, and we can have a conversation like two humans, and I can pay attention, and then the documentation is just automatically created. So that is a real advance. It saves a few minutes, but much more importantly, I think it adds some humanity to the encounter.
I mean, what systems are we using here? Is it as simple as something like ChatGPT, something that a lot of us non-doctors use?
We use a lot of ChatGPT and Gemini and the kind of tools that regular folks use. But for healthcare, these are often specific tools built for these purposes. So, for example, at UCSF, we're using a tool built by a Pittsburgh company named Abridge. That's the one that does the creates my documentation. The tool that summarizes your past record is built by the same company that built our electronic health record called Epic. And then the tool that I use on the wards when I'm taking care of patients to ask medical questions is kind of a version of GPT, but one built for doctors. It's called Open Evidence.
So I wonder, how are the tools that you use different from what some people like to call Dr. Google? And I know real doctors don't like it when we just go to Google and say, well, I have these symptoms. Oh, you must have this. I mean, how does what you're using now differentiate from that?
Well, I'd say, first of all, doctors, we sometimes get a little bit annoyed by it, but I think the idea that patients have it better information at their fingertips and are putting in their information into GPT or Gemini or Claude and getting back answers, I think is overall good. I think it helps them be more informed. Some of the times it will allay their anxiety. But to answer your question, the tools that are built for doctors and for hospitals are built for that purpose. So, for example, the tool I use called Open Evidence basically is like GPT, but whereas GPT looks at the entire internet, meaning it's looking at legitimate medical articles, but also looking at what stuff on X and stuff in Reddit. The tools that I'm using are really looking specifically at the medical literature and at guidelines put out by respected societies. So I think they're using more credible information sources than the tools that patients use. But that said, I think often when I go onto GPT or Gemini and use them for asking medical questions, so the answers tend to be pretty darn good and better than the answers that you would have gotten from Google in the past.
Now, you literally wrote the book on this, and the first three words of your book title, A Giant Leap. How big a leap is this, really, for the medical profession, but also for patients who are sitting there and they're seeing that it's maybe AI that's doing some of the diagnosing and not their good old human doctor?
Yeah, I mean, it's legitimate to be a little scared of this and a little bit anxious about it. And I have to say, when I think about AI and the rest of my life and what it might do to our politics or to jobs, I'm worried. In the specific part of the world that I was writing about, which is healthcare, I think it's overall good. And part of it is the tools are really remarkable. But part of it is the healthcare system really is unable to meet patients' needs today. You know, try to find a mental health professional, try to find a primary care doctor. It's hard to do. Try to get an appointment. So, and if you're a doctor, we're overwhelmed by the amount of information that we have to master, the number of new articles coming out every week. And so overall, I think the combination of what these tools can now do, and really I'm talking about the tools that have just come out over the past few years, the the what's called generative AI, that like GPT, what these tools can do, combined with how difficult it is to navigate our current healthcare system, not only for patients but for doctors. That's what leaves me optimistic. I think healthcare is one of the last industries to be transformed by technology. Think about how you shop or how you get your entertainment or how you do travel. If you take a Waymo, these industries have all been transformed by technology. I'd say overall for the better. Healthcare, we're still stuck in a world of fax machines and pieces of paper flying around. And, you know, it's easier to get a restaurant reservation on OpenTable often than to get a doctor's appointment. So I think it is the unmet needs and unmeetable needs of the healthcare system combined with the power of these tools that makes me pretty optimistic about where we're going to go.
Dr. Wachter, I'm not surprised. We're getting some great questions in from our KCBS listeners, actual humans, no AI needed. Good. For these questions. KCBS listener Mark asks, if AI makes a mistake, say in surgery, who's liable?
Yeah, I think for the time being, high stakes things like surgery or reading your x-ray or making a diagnosis will be done by humans assisted by AI. So there is no AI doing surgery yet. There may be eventually, but what AI is doing in surgery, or you may, if you get a colonoscopy, your doctor may have access to a tool that informs them along the way. So, for example, in colonoscopy, there are AI tools that output a little box around areas of your colon that look suspicious. And it turns out that the gastroenterologists do a better job finding suspicious lesions aided by that. Same thing is true in surgery, where surgeons now have access to AI to help plan the surgery, to help be sure that they cut in the right place and don't cut in the wrong place. But at the end of the day, it's a doctor who's making the final decision. It's a radiologist who's making the final read. And if something goes wrong, we believe that we are accountable and we will be the ones who are liable.
Another KCBS listener asks, how worried should we be about privacy? I think that's a great question because hardly a week goes by where we don't have a story about some sort of data breach somewhere.
Yeah, I think you should be a little worried about it, but your records are already being stored in a digital warehouse by a company. If you are a patient at any healthcare system, pretty much in the country, your records are in an electronic health record, either built by one of the big EHR vendors like Epic or now Oracle. Often then they go up to a corporate cloud, so they're in a cloud built by Microsoft or Amazon or Google. So the risk of your records being in digital form stored somewhere by a company is already out there. The more your records sort of fly around through the ether, obviously it increases the risk. But I think that's not the thing that worries me the most. The thing that worries me the most is deepfakes. That is the fact that that AI can make it look like anybody is saying anything. That has some potential value in medicine. We're seeing examples of digital twins of respected physicians being used to essentially scale up the care so more people can see. If more people wanted to see me, eventually they'll be able to see a digital twin of me that is fueled by my own database. But I'd say the privacy thing is worrisome. You should be careful and thoughtful about it. But it already is an issue. Your records already are in electronic form being stored by a company.
You are listening to Ask an Expert on KCBS. I'm Steve Scott. We are talking about medicine in the AI age with Dr. Bob Wachter, professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at UCSF. You mentioned a bit earlier that we don't have AI doing surgeries yet. Now, I know there's like robotic assisted surgery and things like that, but we don't have just AI taking out somebody's appendix or fixing their ACL or something like that.
Correct. So it's absolutely true. Most surgery these days is done laparoscopically, meaning it's done through a robotic interface. It means that all of the data about the surgery, including the position of the surgeon's hands and where the cut was and all of that is being recorded. It's in the database. And you can be sure those companies are using that in order to get smarter. For the foreseeable future, I can't imagine or envision that your surgery will be done by AI, but I absolutely believe that today, but even more so over the next few years, AI will assist your surgeon, will suggest that they cut here. For example, if they're taking out a cancer, If you've watched the Super Bowl, you see these virtual yard lines and stripes on the field that don't really exist. Even today, surgeons have access to that, which may say, here is where you should cut or here is where you should put a suture. And those sort of tools, assuming they're well-built and they're trustworthy, enhance the surgeon's ability to do their surgery well and safely. It'll be a while before a surgeon before your surgery is done by AI itself.
Very interesting. Here's another question here. I'm going to see if I can shorten this a little bit. The U.S. healthcare system is under immense strain with long wait times for patients and burnout for healthcare workers. How realistic is it that AI can relieve that pressure rather than add new layers of complexity? I didn't shorten it too much, but I think you get the gist of it.
No, that's a great, it's a great question. I think it's the crux of my book, which is part of the reason I'm optimistic is that we come into this in such a problematic situation, and a situation where doctors and nurses are overwhelmed by what they need to do. Patients are frustrated by the amount of paperwork they have got to go through and dealing with the insurance companies and getting authorization for a certain medication and then having to wait months and months to see a primary care doctor or a specialist. The day before GPT came out 3 years ago, it wasn't like I was on Google saying, I wish I had a better search engine. I thought Google was amazing. And yet GPT or Gemini are better. In healthcare, I don't know anybody on the day that GPT came out who said the healthcare system is perfect. There's no way it can be better. Nobody thinks that. Patients don't think that. Doctors don't think that. Nurses don't think that. So I think, as the caller said, the needs are so vast, and I believe that overall AI will make this better. I think it will relieve doctors and nurses of a lot of their paperwork. I think it will give patients information that sometimes will allow them to help manage their own problems themselves or coach them through their problems, and then sometimes just help them navigate the healthcare system in ways that they couldn't do today. So patients right now, through something like MyChart, can get access to MyNote, can get access to their lab results, can access to their EKG, but have often no idea what it means. They'll see my magnesium is low and my EKG is abnormal. And of course, it drives them crazy because they have no idea what that means. AI has the ability now to say, here's not only what it means in general, but here's what it means for you based on your past medical issues and the medications you're on. I think that's tremendously positive, and I think we'll make the system easier to navigate and less frictionful for patients and for doctors.
Oh, another great question here. Many young doctors fear AI will replace them. Are those fears warranted? I think that's a great question because, look, we've got fears of AI taking over a lot of jobs. I mean, heck, we have, you know, computerized balls and strikes being called in baseball.
Well, and computerized journalists, too. So, yes, I think we're all in the same boat.
We try not to talk about that.
And it's legitimate to be worry about this and wonder about it. I would say for most young physicians, and I've got a daughter and son-in-law who are young physicians at UCSF, they are overall positive about this. They see how hard it is to be a doctor, how the frustration and the burnout, largely because of the paperwork or the impossibility of trying to keep up with the advances in medicine. And they see that AI is going to make their professional lives better, easier, take out some of the friction. My last chapter in the book is really getting at this question of, will there be doctors? And my conclusion is, for the foreseeable future, there actually will be just as many doctors and nurses. I think there will be job losses in medicine, but it's going to be in the billing department or in the call center and kind of the administrative functions. I think the unmet needs that patients have in America are so great that I don't think many doctors will lose their jobs. And I think most doctors will welcome AI as a way to make their jobs better and more interesting and more human than what they are today. 10, 20 years from now, I think there are things like radiology or pathology where you're looking at a bunch of digital dots where AI will replace some jobs. But even in fields like that, it turns out that the volume of x-rays, for example, that radiologists have to read is so overwhelming that if AI can make them 20% more productive, they're still all going to have jobs.
Doctor, we have less than a minute left. Our time has really flown by. So I'll ask you, you mentioned, you know, younger doctors in your family. With the help of AI and other tech tools that weren't around, say, when you were starting out, are younger doctors today better than the younger doctors of a generation ago?
Well, that's an unfair question because geezers like me always think that we were the pinnacle of our field and things have gotten worse over time. But no, they are better than we were I think they're more compassionate. I think they think about the big picture and social and economic determinants of health more than we do. But they have these new tools that really make them smarter. And I think the challenge for those of us in medical education is to make sure that we don't take too much off the plate of medical education. It would be a mistake to say they don't have to learn the facts of medicine or clinical reasoning because they have these new AI tools. They still need to be smart because they still need to look over the shoulder of the AI, and they're going to be the ones making the final decisions.
He wrote the book, A Giant Leap, How AI is Transforming Healthcare and What That Means for Our Future. Dr. Bob Wachter, professor and chair of the Department of Medicine at UCSF. Great conversation, very informative. Thanks so much for coming on.
Do you have a dark curiosity? Heart Starts Pounding, Horrors, Hauntings, and Mysteries is a weekly podcast hosted by me, Kaylin Moore. Each week, I'll take you on a dark journey through terrifying true urban legends, bizarre true crime cases, chilling tales of backwoods horror, and more. So if you're looking to join a passionate community of the darkly curious, check out Heart Starts Pounding on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, stay curious.
Dr. James Grant, the Executive Vice President and Chief Medical Officer of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. February is American Heart Month. And, you know, heart disease is really, I think, the top killer in America of people. And people are getting heart disease younger and younger. And what are you seeing?
Beth, we're seeing heart disease younger and younger. And the reason we're seeing heart disease younger and younger is we're seeing those factors that lead to heart disease younger and younger. We're seeing obesity younger and younger. We're seeing diabetes younger and younger. We're seeing stress younger and younger. You add all these things up, you're going to start seeing heart disease younger and younger.
The CDC says that there's been a 66% increase in heart attacks in people 18 to 44 since 2019. I mean, that's just shocking. Doesn't that shock you?
It's shocking. Not only is it shocking, but anecdotally, if you think about it, you know, you're hearing more and more of, you know, you had a friend or a friend's, you know, son or daughter having heart issues. You didn't hear about that 20 years ago. You go into a cardiology clinic, it's no longer, you know, seniors. It's people of all ages in there now. So heart disease is no longer a, quote, you know, a senior disease. Heart disease is something that can affect everybody.
So for young people, what are some signs that they might have heart disease or develop it?
The signs that they may have heart disease, and the sign, you know, that they may develop, is, you know, those are the things they need to avoid. They need to start watching their weight. They need to start watching their diet. They need to start watching your cholesterol. Be sure, I mean, sometimes when you're, you know, 30 some odd years old or 20 some odd years old, you think you're invincible. It's not true. You can, any age, you can get disease. See your primary care physician. Don't smoke. Eat right, manage your blood sugar, control your blood pressure, minimize the stress. I know we're in a world where we're used to hitting a button and magically, you know, something, you know, the food you want to eat shows up at your doorstep. Chill a little bit. Realize that, you know, we're going to take life one step at a time.
One of the other issues we're going to discuss is there are some subtle signs of a silent heart attack. And what are those?
Those are things like you think you've got the flu, sort of, maybe, somewhat. You have like a sore muscle in your chest or your upper back. Sometimes you have this ache. One of the things people will realize when you have like an ache in your jaw or a neck and your upper back, and or it's like in your neck radiating to your jaw, that's a sure sign. You're very tired. You're very tired all the time. One of the greatest things you'll see in, you know, emergency departments when people come in complaining, I've got this bad indigestion that just won't go away. That's a really telltale sign of some impending heart disease. And then you've got the classic symptoms, the classic chest pain. And the story you'll hear is someone said, and it's not pain like knives, but some like pressure, like an elephant sitting on your chest. And shortness of breath, dizziness, a lightheadedness, cold sweats, nausea and vomiting. These are all things that, you know, are symptoms of a traditional heart attack.
There are different signs in women.
There's different signs. So when I was talking about things like the jaw pain, arm pain, those are signs that we see a little more predominantly in females than we do in males. Males can get those symptoms too. Females can get the traditional male symptoms. But The female symptoms are a little different, but there's a lot of overlap in there, Beth. So I wanted to tell everyone, regardless if you're male or female, if you've got these symptoms, take a closer look. The female symptoms are a little more subtle, a little more silent, and need to be addressed even quicker.
If something seems a little off, what should you do?
You got to use some judgment. A little off, make an arrangement to see your primary care physician. Maybe we worked up for heart disease. If it's a lot off, and if you think you're having some acute cardiac issues, you got to stop by your emergency department.
Now, the other thing we want to talk about is there's a connection, apparently, between heart health and mental health. How is that?
We're seeing more and more. We're seeing heart health and mental health. You know, when you've got issues, mental health issues, behavioral health issues, depression, it affects the whole body. And we're seeing that more and more. Your mental health really does affect your physical health. So, you know, if you've got signs and symptoms of behavioral issues, like I said, like I think depression is the one I like to bring up because it's very common. It affects more than just your mental well-being. It also affects your physical well-being. And we know that. And what it does, it affects a lot of your hormones. And then you get these flights, you know, if you're uptight, nervous all the time, you know, these fight or flight responses, which then you excrete hormones that then affect your heart. These are things you need to, if you can address the mental health issues, it will actually cascade to the physical health issues.
Aside from, you know, seeing someone, maybe you need something for your mental health. Maybe you need medication or talk therapy. Oh, yeah. What about exercise? How important is that?
Exercise is crucially important. Exercise is crucially important, really, Beth, for both your heart, other organs in your body, your physical health, and your mental health. There's nothing more if you've got anxiety. You know, we've shown that anxiety actually can increase the chances of heart disease. Think about it. You're anxious. You produce hormones. Those hormones actually go to your heart. And when you're exercising, you tend to like run off those things that are worrying you. So you tend to run off things that are getting you down. And it improves your heart health. So it's actually a win-win-win exercise. It's improving your mental health and it's improving your physical health.
And I guess if you're having anxiety or depression, what would you recommend?
See a professional.
Anything to add?
The only thing I want to add is we talked about this being Heart Healthy Month. Although I like the term and I love that we spend February focusing on heart health, I want heart health to be something in your everyday life. 365 days a year, 12 months a year. We've got to just focus on the heart because we're given a set of genes, and a set of genes will make a lot of determinations for us. But we also have some things in our control. So do remember, we were only given one heart. Let's do our best to take the best care of it.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Berry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Dana Carvey.
I'm David Spade.
Fly on the Wall's back for another season now on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
So many incredible guests will be joining us.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Too good to be true.